It is 2:06 on Monday afternoon. Welcome to Political Rewind on the first full day of President Trump's work in the office. He told us that Monday was going to be the first real day of work, as we'll discuss in a little while. He was pretty busy over the weekend, too. We'll get to that. But he's already undone a number of executive orders and other actions taken by President Obama, as he promised to do. And we will talk about those on the show today with my partner, Jim Galloway, the political writer from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read his column on Thursdays and Sundays, and he oversees the Political Insider blog. Jim, which I've mentioned last week and want to again, I'm proud to say, you are now posting Political Rewind on the blog, so people can hear it there if they can't hear it on the radio.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, and I am here today to offer the alternative facts.
Okay.
This discussion.
Former Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin joins us today as well. Thank you so much for being back with us, Shirley. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Chip Lake, a Republican strategist. He's been a frequent visitor to the show, and we always like having Chip on. Welcome, Chip. You
Thanks
didn't go
for
up to the
me.
Inauguration, did you?
I did not. I watched it from here, so I did not attend.
And you know who else didn't go? Beth Shapiro, a former pollster in politics for mostly Democrats and also for businesses, now happily sort of retired. Thank you for being here, and we're glad you're not so retired you won't do this show with some regularity.
I'm happy to be here and happy to have been here over the weekend.
Okay. Let's start talking first, before we go to Donald Trump, before we go to the protest marches over the weekend, one of which Shirley Franklin was one of the leaders of. Let's talk for just a minute about this awful weather story from South Georgia. Went through areas around Adel. That's, I think, 170th legislative district all through South Georgia near Valdosta. Jim, there have been now varying reports. This morning, AP said at least 15 deaths. Now there's some question. The point is, it's been devastating.
And it's been chaotic. And that's why you've seen some variation in the fatality figures, because people get counted one or two times. We know that Governor Nathan Deal will go down there Wednesday, which is a signal, I think, that he's waiting for things to get under control.
Yeah.
That he doesn't want to step on law enforcement as they're trying to regain control of the situation.
In fact, on yesterday, President Trump had a few remarks about what happened in Georgia. Let's listen to what he said.
You know, I just spoke with Governor Nathan Deal of Georgia. Great state, great people. Florida affected, Alabama affected by the tornadoes, and just expressed our sincere condolences for the lives taken. Tornadoes were vicious and powerful and strong, and they suffered greatly. So we'll be helping out the state of Georgia. So on behalf of all of us, Governor Deal, condolences.
That was President Trump yesterday. Just a few minutes ago, we talked to State Senator Ellis Black, who represents that district down there. Let's listen to just a little bit of what he had to tell us. Well, Senator, we appreciate your taking just a couple of minutes, and we extend our thoughts to the people down in your district who are struggling the way they are. What are you hearing from your constituents in the worst-hit areas?
Well, I was just when you get up there and just north of Lowndes County, where the tornado hit, it sort of started about morning and went sort of in a northeastern direction through Cook County on into Berrien County, and that's where the deaths occurred. And in Cook County, that tornado went right through the middle of a trailer park, or just wiped out a whole trailer park. And that's where the biggest of the deaths occurred right there, because there were older trailers, there was a bunch of rental properties, and they just could not withstand that tornado. We had from 7 to 9 inches of rain, plus some real high wind, and we sustained a lot of damage because of the amount of water that came so fast. And the dirt roads particularly, they are messed up big time, and it caused some erosion in the fields that's going to require some additional work on the part of the farmer.
You're expecting emergency help from Governor Deal, and you're going to get it, we now know.
Well, I certainly hope so, because the local governments are just not in any position to cover the cost of repairing these roads and getting things back in the normal.
So that's Senator Ellis Black. The governor did, Jim, declare 16 counties, I think, down there emergency. It triggered emergency funding to help them repair.
Right, but these are communities that are living just on the edge of things, and it's going to be just devastating economically for them.
Yeah, and that's why I think our thoughts all go out.
I would just add that, I mean, this is reflective of what governments, hopefully organized by the state, do. It's not just response. It's also preparedness. I mean, the ability of local communities to be prepared in advance, to have the kind of communications they need, to have alternatives for people who are facing heavy rains or snow or ice or whatever it is. And my experience at the city is that there's great reluctance to work outside of your own political jurisdiction. And the only one that has the authority to kind of force that is going to be the state of Georgia.
I want to be clear, though. There's no suggestion of what you're saying that somehow the state might have been better prepared for a fast-moving storm like this, right? You're not suggesting that.
No, I am not saying that you can be prepared for the storm. You can be prepared to respond to a storm.
Yeah.
You can be prepared to have the kind of alert system that you need so that people know farther in advance that a storm is coming. I was asked once on national television, what was my response to a problem? I guess it was Katrina and evacuation. Well, at that time, there was no evacuation plan for metropolitan Atlanta. So City of Atlanta could have an evacuation plan, but you can't evacuate the City of Atlanta without understanding how you relate to the other jurisdictions. So we couldn't stop the storm, but we could be prepared for the evacuation should the storm be imminent. And that I'm not blaming anyone, but I do think it is an issue, probably not just in Georgia, but in other states as well.
It strikes me, Chip Lake, that I thought maybe another direction to take this, we'll move on in a sec, but this is also when government can be at its best. You know, there's so much talk about keep government out of my life and that sort of thing, and yet it's in emergencies like these where we recognize that state and federal government help is really essential.
There's no question, and the people of South Georgia are going to need our help, both at the state level and the federal level. And so I know the governor's going down there on Wednesday, and our thoughts and prayers are out with everybody down there, because we don't know exactly what the death toll numbers are, and I'm not even 100% sure that they're in the clear as far as, there might be some more weather, today down in that area. So certainly this will be a time where government can help.
All right. Again, our thoughts go out to the people of South Georgia right now and those who lost loved ones down there. By the way, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB to become part of the conversation. We encourage you to do just that, because we want to what you're saying as the show moves forward. Bev Shapiro,
let's turn
to this extraordinary few days in the transition of power from one president to the next. We're going to talk in a couple minutes a little bit about the Trump inaugural speech, but in many ways that was eclipsed, the Friday inauguration, by what took place over the weekend. We saw on Saturday the president and his senior team decide to make an issue out of the fact that national news organizations showed photographs comparing the 2009 Obama crowd with the 2017 Trump crowd, and it caused a firestorm among Trump senior officials. Yes?
Yes, it did. I think that we have a president and a team surrounding him who are concerned about his ascending into the office of the presidency being seen as legitimate. I think that, they're not happy when people point out that almost 3 million more people voted for his opponent than for him. They're not happy when they point out that the Russians hacked, the Russian hacking was intended to have an impact on the election. And so when pictures appear that that are factual and that show that, there was a smaller crowd size for his inauguration than for President Obama's, then he's upset. And I think the real problem here, though, is that he has a remarkably thin skin. And it's one thing to have a thin skin, but have it under control and have people around you that can keep that under control. But over the course of the campaign and over the transition and now over the first couple of days of his presidency, he's shown no ability to control that. And to me, that's the most disturbing aspect of this as far as the kinds of responsibilities that lie in his hands.
Well, no. First of all, I mean, you know, number wise, of course there were more people out for the Obama. I mean, D.C. is a Democratic town. Donald Trump got 4% of the vote. Yes, he's unless he imports his visitors, they're going to be a lesser number. I mean, I'm a little bit more cynical. I think this is training. I think this is training for the press. I think it is training for the public. We are going to have many, many debates over employment and whether it goes up and down, whether jobs are created or whether they're not created. And I think this is our first dose of training on who's going to rule the numbers.
Right. And you've set us up beautifully for playing a little sound of what happened over the weekend. I want to start, though, by saying, Chip Lake, I think that the way certainly the Washington Post, the New York Times, a few other national publications played the crowd discrepancy, I have to tell you, I thought they did it kind of gleefully.
They were baiting the
president in some ways to show the aerial or the pictures from the top of the Washington Monument. They seemed to take delight in showing us the discrepancy in the crowd size.
They did, and the White House took the bait, and the press secretary took the bait. And I guess we all shouldn't be surprised that they did, but in a 48 to 72 hour period when they could be talking about the executive orders that the president made to freeze federal workers' pay, to freeze hiring, to begin the withdrawal process from the TPP trade deal for Obamacare, we've spent the last 72 hours discussing crowd sizes, and I'm not so sure that's the direction. So hopefully it's a good lesson learned for them. I know that Sean Spicer is giving, as we speak, his second press conference. Hope it goes a little bit better than
that. Yeah, let's back up again just a step. So Donald Trump went to the CIA on Saturday. He made it his first official visit to a government agency, and we'll talk about why in a second. But while he was there, presumably to honor the fallen and to tell CIA, I'm on your side, he got into a rather rambling improvisation, including this.
We had, it looked like 1.5 million people, whatever it was. But it went all the way back to the Washington Monument. And I turn on the thing, and by mistake, I get this network. And it showed an empty field. And it said, we drew 250,000 people. Now, that's not bad, but it's a lie. So we caught them, and we caught them in a beauty. And I think they're going to pay a big price.
All right, just to keep the sequence going, shortly after that, Sean Spicer, the new White House press secretary, had his first briefing in the White House briefing room. It was rather short. It lasted for 5 minutes. He did not, as typically happens in those briefings, take questions from the press. Instead, he lectured.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period, both in person and around the globe. These attempts to lessen the enthusiasm of the inauguration are shameful and wrong.
Shirley Franklin, what do you make of all this?
Well, I don't think it's very different from the campaign itself, which is kind of the angry responses and shying away from, you know, saying one thing one day and another thing another day. It's unfortunate, however, though, because most Americans are ready for the governance of the Trump administration. And as Chip has said, we've spent all of this time debating who came and why they came and how many people were there. But unfortunately, it sounds more like a campaign to me than a group of people, whether the president or or the press secretary, understanding they are in a governance position. And then the next announcement was, we are going to fight you tooth and nail on every fact and every point. We're not the enemy. The American public nor the media are the enemy.
Jim, the president did say at the CIA that he's in a running war with the media. And the thing about this is, Chip kind of points out here, such a small matter to be blown out of proportion by the White House.
Well, and it was also a missed opportunity. I mean, you'd spent the last 6 weeks bedeviling the U.S. intelligence agencies, and you had a chance to go and make up. You go to their most sacred spot. And you talk about something that's rather insipid. When you have them listening and ready to jump on your side.
It's the politics of resentment that got him elected, and apparently he and his advisors feel that the politics of resentment are what are going to make him a successful president. I would strongly disagree with that thought, but that appears to be the direction they're going to go in, and part of that resentment is stoking anger at the so-called mainstream media.
So this all took a truly bizarre turn yesterday when Kellyanne Conway, now a senior advisor to the president, appeared on Meet the Press. She was on all the morning shows, but Meet the Press is the one that got all the attention. As she and Chuck Todd battled over Todd's question to her of why the White House chose this battle, why they sent Sean Spicer into the briefing room to make a statement that was demonstrably untrue. Let's just play a little of this exchange. If you didn't see it, you should hear it.
I did answer your question.
No, you
did
not. You did not answer the question of why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood. Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office on day one.
No, it doesn't. Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Alternative facts? Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered. The
hey,
one
Chuck,
thing he
why,
got
hey,
right
Chuck.
Was Zeke Miller. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
Maybe this is me as a pollster, Chuck, and you know data well. I don't think you can prove those numbers one way or the other. There's no way to really quantify crowds. We all know that. You can laugh at me all you want, but I'm very
laughing.
Glad.
I'm
Look,
just
Chuck,
befuddled.
But you are, and I think it's actually symbolic of the way we're treated by the press. The way that you just laughed at me is actually symbolic of the way, very representative of the way we're treated by the press. I'll just ignore it. I'm bigger than that. I'm a kind and gracious person.
Where's all this headed, Chip?
Well, I don't think anybody knows, Bill, and I think that's what makes this such a fascinating time in American politics. And you know, the only data point that we have, or the only data point that I've been able to find with respect to knowing exactly how many people attended the inauguration, are metro ridership numbers. And the numbers that Sean Spicer cited was 420,000 people rode the Metropolitan, rode the Metro Rail that day for Trump's inauguration. And he cited 317,000 for Obama's inauguration in 2013. The problem is, 12 hours later, the Washington Post went back and found data that showed actually more people had ridden the Metro Rail cars for Trump's inauguration. It was 571, but the numbers on Obama's inauguration were 782.
Problem. You point out that this is the beginning. This is a trial. They're testing. They're testing.
Call it training. They're training.
And
who are they training?
Well, they're training the media. They're looking to see how far they can go in pushing the media and how their supporters and the American people will respond.
At the end of this month and at the end of every month for the next 4 years, we're going to have job reports. All right, and those numbers are going to go up. They're going to go down, and we're going to be faced with some reporting those numbers. And the White House intends to make clear that it will tell us the numbers that are really right, no matter what they are.
So we now are Shirley Franklin. Look, you're the one person in this studio right now who has been in an elected high elected office as mayor. Can you imagine what happened? How do you deal with your credibility, telling the truth, even in tough times as a mayor, or at any office?
Well, I mean, people are using the word befuddled. I mean, it is really just, it's circus-like in many ways. You said it, I said it, no, we said it, and it goes back and forth. It is a complete waste of time. When you spend this much time on the kinds of things that we've seen for 72 hours, and hopefully will not see any more of, you are wasting the people's time. But you're wasting their money. And you don't ever want to give bad news. Whoever wants to give bad news?
This is a woman who became the sewer mayor,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to give bad news. The sewers are going to cost $3 billion. Nobody wants to pay more. Or the cities were shut down for a major sporting event because of ice. Who wants to admit the plan didn't work?
But your credibility is everything. Everything you have, isn't it?
Well, it depends on whether you believe you are bigger than the job or you are trying to live up to the job.
One of the problems that this president starts out with is that he squandered the somewhat of a bump in approval ratings that he had earned right after the election. And he starts office with roughly a 40% approval rating. And that means that 60% of the country, many of whom get their news from the national broadcast networks, not the cable networks necessarily, many of whom get their news from their local newspapers and from national newspapers, what they're reading now, what they're hearing now, is two sets of what are called facts, the facts and the alternative facts. And he's setting in stone, or he's going to be setting in stone, expectations of whatever comes out of the White House. I need to double check because it may not be true. And it comes right back to credibility. And when something serious happens, and unfortunately something serious will happen at some point, there will be a terror attack or something, or our troops may be attacked overseas, and the president stands up to speak to us, or his press secretary stands up to speak to us, we may not be as inclined to believe him as we would be if he didn't start out his administration this way.
All right. We have more to talk about in terms of Donald Trump. And in fact, I want to contrast Saturday to Sunday with the president, because there was a very definite change of tone when he yesterday was part of the swearing in of his senior staff at the White House. And it reflects something we'll talk about, which is apparently some real infighting among senior staff at the White House. But let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way, because it's already 2:28 on Monday afternoon. You're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
A new chapter in history has begun.
President-elect Donald Trump is an unprecedented figure in many respects.
The future is full of questions.
If corrupt individuals wanted to take advantage of a connection between Trump properties and the White House, how would they do it?
Was this the stumbling of an amateur or a more deliberate negotiating move?
And NPR will be there every step of the way to help you make sense of it all. Listen every day.
Join us for Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on GPB.
Journalist Alan Burdick has spent a long time thinking about time, pondering questions like, what's the meaning of now?
Yeah, you know, I spent like 10 years peering into that well and came out of it and felt like I had a long white beard.
More from his book, Why Time Flies. Also, coverage of the new administration as President Trump gets to work on his agenda. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 4 till 7 on your GPB station.
We're back on Political Rewind. Our guest today in the studio, former mayor of Atlanta, Shirley Franklin, is with us. Republican strategist Chip Lake, former retired now pollster and consultant Beth Shapiro, and our good friend Jim Galloway of the AJC. Hey, Jim, you're back now. The session's in. They're back.
They're back, and they're not taking up a lot of bills yet. We had a little action in Senate rules today, where they kind of turned down Josh McCune's bid to kind of tamp down on hand votes or voice votes in that chamber. Didn't work. They got killed.
What a surprise. God forbid they should be able to vote without making sure everybody knows exactly where they stand. Let's talk more about Donald Trump, though. And again, join the conversation. You can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. One last soundbite from Saturday, and then I want to play a little bit about Sunday. When Donald Trump was at the CIA, he said that he was absolutely supportive and honored their work.
So I can only say that I am with you 1,000%. And the reason you're my first stop is that, as you know, I have a running war with the media. They are among the most dishonest human beings on earth. What? And they sort of made it sound like I had a feud with the intelligence community. And I just want to let you know, the reason you're number one stop, it is exactly the opposite. Exactly. And they understand that, too.
Jim, here we go again.
Here we go again. This is what we just talked about, except just on another topic.
Yeah, yeah. But I wanted to play that before. So again, this is Trump on Saturday. And we now are told in reading reports that there was tremendous conflict within his senior staff over whether or not the president should make a big deal out of crowd size. You've got Kellyanne Conway's, Steve Bannon, who definitely are pushing, urging the president to be as confrontational as possible. We don't really know, Chip, like, where Reince Priebus, his new chief of staff, stands on all of this. But the reporting today suggests there are an awful lot of people in the Trump higher levels of the administration were not happy about how things went on Saturday.
Yeah, no, I can only imagine. I mean, one of the things I think they're going to, first of all, they all need to work to gel as a team, and that's never easy when you're in any type of administration that just comes in, especially this one. But another dynamic I think they're going to have to deal with very, very quickly is a very basic dynamic that whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, if you've been in a position to lead, if you've been in an executive position, it's the dynamic of offense, defense. When you're a candidate, you can go on offense as much as you'd like. You're going to spend some time on defense. When you get sworn in and you have the responsibility of leading and the responsibility of governing, anybody will tell you, you spend much more of your time on defense than you do on offense. He doesn't like to be there. But when you're a president, you win and you lose. How's he going to take losing? We'll see.
This shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody, because this is how he ran the Trump organization. He likes to set up competing centers of power. And it's a very deliberate setup, as best I can read and understand from what I've read about it, to have you've got Reince Priebus, the chief of staff. You've got Steve Bannon, senior counsel. Then you've got his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who's kind of the Reign Trump Inn advisor. And they've each got different notions about what he should be doing.
So I do want to point out that it is not unusual for a new administration to get off to a somewhat rocky start in terms of the media, particularly. I, Jim, remember 1993, January of 1993, right after President Clinton took the oath of office and gave his inaugural speech, we all went back to the White House, to the briefing room. To George Stephanopoulos, who was doing press for him at that point, was going to have something to say to all of us. And we just to explain what happens here, the media has always had free access from the briefing room into the West Wing to the office of the press secretary and the communications director. Mm-hmm. It's an open corridor. And that means that any reporter, and this is going to really be a problem for the Trump people potentially if they don't change this, you can walk in there and just hang around and wait for the press secretary to look up and make sure you can ask your question. The Clinton people put a red rope up separating the briefing room from the West Wing. And something as trivial as that, Jim, caused a firestorm that afternoon.
Let me offer on his remarks at the CAA. Let me offer an alternative thought that just came to me. Okay, you have the president of the United States standing in front of his intelligence people, with whom he has feuded over the last 6 months or 6 weeks. I'm sorry, and he starts pointing to the media. I.e., we have a common enemy. These guys over here are the bad guys.
Saying this to the American people.
No. He's saying that he's speaking to the intelligence community that is already investigating him on his campaign's contacts with Russia and a couple other matters associated with the campaign. I think that's an interesting triangle of dynamics there.
All right. I said we were going to listen to how he changed his tone on Sunday when apparently there were people in the White House who said, please, we've got to lower the temperature here. Here he was at the swearing-in ceremony for senior staff, Reince Priebus, Jared Kushner, Kellyanne Conway, and others.
This is not about party. This is not about ideology. This is about country, our country. And it's about serving the American people. We will face many challenges, but with the faith in each other and the faith in God, we will get the job done. We will prove worthy of this moment in history, and I think it may very well be a great moment in history.
All right. That was the calmer Trump. We will watch and see, and we'll find out how this press briefing goes with Sean Spicer to see if they have made a change in tone. A few tweets. Khalid says, Jim, in response to you, Trump isn't training the media. He's training the masses to believe that facts themselves are debatable. Edward Funch says, so far so good with Trump presidency. Got a Geiger counter hooked up my roof. Haven't heard a peep. Shirley Franklin, so far today and over the weekend, President Trump issued an executive order telling every agency that was involved in some way or another with the Affordable Care Act to begin looking at such ways in which they can pull back from that involvement. We don't know all the specifics of that. It's just a broad order that's going to give them some freedom on things, perhaps continuing care for people with pre-existing conditions, that sort of thing. This morning, he decided to pull back, to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. How important do you think that kind of global trade is to the state of Georgia?
Well, historically, the mayors, including myself, joined governors and our senators in really supporting trade agreements. I've come to realize that there are lots of details about that can be problematic. Clearly, when I was in office, these trade agreements were among those that I considered supporting. Some of them I was actively actually engaged in the conversations. But the challenge here is that, and I also chaired the platform committee for the Democratic Convention, and this was a huge debate within the Democratic Party. So just as the country might have been split on the election, many people in the country are on either side of this conversation. Certainly within the Democratic Party, that was the case.
Yeah.
I am curious as to how this is going to play out. These trade agreement assessments are going to play out even among the Democrats in the House.
Yeah,
Senate.
You got a hint from Rex Tillerson during his hearings that he was willing to back a couple steps off, change a few little items in there, and maybe take another run at it in a fashion that Trump could call his own. So we might not see the end of it. Bill, but you mentioned the Obamacare executive order. That is the one thing in the inaugural address that actually shocked me.
That
it was completely missing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm wondering if that is a signal that he realizes just how dicey a move that repeal and replace is.
Yeah, we can.
Well, repeal is dicey. Replace is much more complicated.
You know, let me go back to TPP just for a minute, because Shirley Franklin, I think, made an important point. It certainly there is a debate to be had over free trade. Maybe Democrats, Shirley was, chair of the platform committee, maybe might argue the Democrats should have highlighted that controversy a little more, because it might have won them some votes, since there was not much conversation aimed at those people who ended up voting for Trump because they think they lost their jobs to global trade. So it is fair that the president may want to reassess how to deal with these kind of, and NAFTA, he's also already said he's begun conversations with Mexico and Canada about some changes in NAFTA. Chip?
Well, and I think he wants to prove to those states that really handed him the Electoral College, states like Michigan the Rust Belt states to say, hey, you know, when I was campaigning, I campaigned on withdrawing from the TPP agreement and other free trade agreements. And as Mayor Franklin said, it's a big debate with her party, but trust me, it's also a big debate with our party. And the president is going to attend at the beginning of every Congress. Both parties have retreats. They get away. They get out of Washington, D.C. The Republicans are going this year to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania this weekend. And I believe, don't quote me on this, but I believe it's a bicameral meeting with Republican leaders and with Senate leaders and with House leaders. And the president's going to attend. And I tell you, to be a fly on the wall for those discussions and believe his domestic policy team and his foreign policy team are going to be there. And I can assure you that trade and tariffs will be high on the list of priority, along with infrastructure projects, things that he said. One other thing, and then I'll be quiet and kind of hear everybody else. But if you were to not have listened to Trump's inaugural speech, but only read the transcript of the speech, 80 to 85% of that speech is a speech that Bernie Sanders could have given had he been elected president. So this really is a different time. So it'll be interesting to see how the
The interesting thing about the trade issue is that it's one, if Trump were so inclined to try to get something done in a bipartisan way, it's something where he could find some Democrats who'd be with him. And sure. I think he'll find there's some Republicans who'll lose. But it really is an issue where somebody deft somebody with legislative skill or people around him with legislative skill could possibly find a way forward on it.
Yeah, but I think you make a point. I mean, look, Jim, it's a Republican Party and certainly Republicans in Congress who have been the biggest supporters of global trade, free trade.
Right.
They're the party of business.
Right. The problem with Beth, with what you just said, is that you're going to need a hefty Republican member of Congress to put that deal together. And free trade is so embedded in the GOP thought process. I don't think you can find that person.
So I think another complication here is that and I'm sure the president will, this style will change. This simplicity with which he describes his position does not do justice to the complexity of the issue or the facts.
Why do you think that style will change?
Well, I think in order to get anything done, it's going to have to change. This just pronouncement, this is good, this is bad, you're great, you're not great, that's so simplistic. Clearly the conversation, either from the president or from key leadership in the House and Senate, is going to have to get much more nuanced and much more in depth.
And that might be the first battle to determine who really within the senior staff at the White House can connect with this president-elect, because you know that's probably something both sides of those factions agree with, what the mayor said.
Before we leave TPP altogether, I just want to throw out some figures that I think are worth sharing.
Are these facts or alternative facts?
These are facts. This is from the International Trade Administration, which is a division of the Commerce Department. Here's what they say about the value of global trade, of TPP trading partners to the state of Georgia. $15 billion in goods exported from Georgia to TPP countries in 2015. $1.4 billion in goods to Japan, $405 million to Vietnam, $210 million to Malaysia. 39% of Georgia goods exports went to TPP countries, 39% in 2015. 5,600 companies from Georgia exported goods to TPP countries in 2014, and 84% were small and medium-sized companies. Now, Jim, to put those figures into a political context, this was the Obama Commerce Department. So these figures are obviously, we have no reason to doubt they're true, but clearly they're there to make the best case scenario for why they should have done TPP.
Right, right. But I will tell you right now, if you are a South Georgia farmer and you're looking at Sonny Perdue becoming the Secretary of Agriculture, the number thing you want him to do is to avoid a trade war with China right now. Mm-hmm. Because that's where your produce is going.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take a look at a couple of the other things that President Trump did today. He signed an order to freeze federal hiring. It's something that he had talked about during the campaign, so it does fulfill a campaign promise. That doesn't mean he won't be able to put political appointees in place. He will. The order doesn't exclude those. What's interesting about it is the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, has said over the years that hiring freezes don't really have the kind of government hiring freezes, the kind of impact that any president who puts them in place would want to. And they were responding to Jimmy Carter doing something like that during his tenure. So,
well, I don't know about the federal level. Certainly that is something that I did and that most mayors have done, which is to get a handle on who's in which positions, to understand where you might be able to do some reorganization. So I'm not surprised by the hiring freeze.
But I will tell you what, if you're a president at the top of a federal bureaucracy, what you're doing is you're saying, yeah, you want a hiring freeze, and that sounds good and sounds great. But I will tell you, the workarounds are there.
Well, that's exactly right.
You just move people into new positions. You don't have to give them raises.
Called privatizing. It's when you then contract out services that previously were handled by government employees, and now they're handled by consulting firms or transportation firms or just a whole range of areas where the work still gets done. It's just done by the private sector with government dollars.
So the key is to do the hiring freeze, the contracting freeze. I mean, you've got to go beyond that, which is really my earlier point, that this is a complex organization, and the response of any administration has to assume that complexity. Otherwise, it's not going to be successful.
All right, but to give the president his due, Chip, he is starting to fulfill promises he made during his campaign, and his voters are going to be thrilled that he is beginning that process.
They are, and look, any president, when they come into office, no matter what party you are, you're going to issue some executive orders when you get sworn in or very shortly thereafter. To basically show everybody that voted for you and show the people that are covering you and watching you, too, that I'm going to follow through on some of the promises that I made during the campaign. So while these are largely symbolic, I got to think even a lot of people that didn't vote for Donald Trump and maybe a lot of the base and some of the independents are probably looking at this going, that makes a lot of sense. We should have a hiring freeze. We should freeze, pay increases for federal employees. But as the mayor said, we'll see how long it lasts. I mean, I don't know exactly how much work he's doing to get up to speed on what all he's going to need within the federal government. My guess is probably not a lot with everything on his plate, but there are those around him who can do that for him. The question is, we'll see how good of a listener he is in this new position.
Mm-hmm. Jim, you point out that he did not mention ACA in the inauguration speech. He also didn't talk about what he was going to do about immigration, but we're told over the weekend that he will have some kind of executive order on immigration. To the best of my knowledge, we haven't heard what the details are yet.
And the key is going to be what happens to the Dream Kids, I think.
Exactly.
I think that is going, because that will create the image. That's where the TV cameras will go after this, whether they're packed up and sent over the border to countries they barely know or not.
All right, Jim Galloway, we're going to take a break now, our last break of the show. But when we come back, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about a story that you all had in Political Insider that I thought was kind of stunning. It has to do with the CDC and questions about whether the CDC may be bending to the will of the new president of the United States. It's 2:49 on Monday afternoon. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Are you thinking of getting rid of your old car, truck, or RV? GPB's vehicle donation program is here to help. Donating has never been easier. We'll take care of everything, including free pickup of your vehicle. Just go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR. That's 877-472-1227. And thanks so much.
The best Beatles song of all time. Shirley Franklin, I cannot believe that we've been so fortunate to have you here today, and I did not yet ask you. You led a 60-some thousand-member march, you and John Lewis, here in Atlanta on Saturday. One of the marches took place all over the world. Tell us about it.
All over the world. Every continent, every state was represented. Over 600 grassroots marches, largely around the issues of women's rights, which was the foundation of the march. But people came from all points of view, from most points of view, really to express their concerns. And the primary concern was to say President Trump and his administration, but also to the Congress and to the state houses and state leadership, that they are going to stand up and they're going to be heard. Now, in Atlanta, the expectation was that there would be 10,000 marchers. It was over 60,000.
On a really bad weather day, too.
Well, on a day that cleared up, thank you. but it did start out pretty rainy. It was thrilling and exciting, racially integrated, multi-generation, young children all the way through grandparents like myself, families. And across the nation and across the really across the world, the marches were safe. They were respectful of each other, and they were very, very high spirits.
So, what was your primary message to the crowd?
My primary message was that if you care about an issue, you have to organize, you have to register to vote, you have to be engaged, and you have to be consistent and not give up.
Well, and that is the question, I think, Jim.
I think what we're seeing here is exactly what we saw in 2009, except on the other side. This is the Tea Party movement of the left. And what strikes me is that what happened on Saturday was kind of unfocused. It was a general protest of Trump's ascension to power. I think what's going to be interesting is when you have very specific actions by the Trump administration, like on Obamacare or like on immigration, when crowds like that have something to focus on, that's when I think it's going to get very interesting.
I think what will happen is, and I was there also, and blown away by the size, having participated in a march or two down Peachtree Street back when we used to march down Peachtree Street, where we each knew the other 1,000 or so people marching, to see 60,000 people walk in front of me while I was staying at the Capitol was just amazing. But I think what was so interesting about this group is that there were a lot of issues and causes that were represented. I think the unifying piece that got a lot of people there were just kind of the agency of women and just the importance of women and women's issues and rights that are very much in threatened now. But there were people representing who were concerned about the environment, concerned about LGBT rights. There were people concerned about immigration and refugee rights. And so for any cause, any issue that motivated you to march Saturday, there are several organizations, and I'm not going to name names because I'll get in trouble for leaving some out, but there are a number of advocacy organizations addressing any of these issues, and I think that's where the rubber will hit the road, is that people will look to become engaged either through an issue, or we have municipal elections statewide this year. I would look for people to become involved in the campaigns of progressive candidates for local office.
Right, but it showed you what a vast pool there is to draw from on each one of those issues.
Shirley Franklin, we do have a question from one of our faithful tweeters, Thought Crime. He says, why did Women's March not want pro-life women pro-life women's groups involved? Is that fair?
It is fair. I don't think anyone was turned away. The question is whether they were encouraged to come and speak as speakers in some way. But it was very much a march around reproductive rights, women's rights, immigration rights, and human rights generally. And it was not a debate. I mean, people there were of general like mind that these were the progressive issues that were being left out in the current administration.
So Galloway says, as others have, this is sort of the Tea Party of the left. We know what power the Tea Party was able to exert on the elections of 2010, the off-year elections. Do you believe that there's a mobilization that Beth kind of hints at that will, in fact, empower the kinds of people who turned out across the country Saturday?
I don't know the answer to that yet, but I can tell you that the organizers of this march were not people whose names you would know. They were people who were concerned. They were young people. They were 30-somethings. They were as surprised as everyone else that 60,000 people came. They touched a chord. They hit a nerve. And the fact that they were able to do that suggests to me there's more to come.
Chip?
In 2009, those same people that led the Tea Party movement were not necessarily people in names that you had heard associated with modern-day politics going on. And I'll say this, too. Anytime your party holds the White House and then you lose a presidential election, there is no bigger wake-up call to your base than that type of dynamic. And we saw it with our party in 2009 with the beginning and the formation of the Tea Party. And I think you probably saw something similar with that to the march. The question will be, what role do they play and how do they hold Democratic elected officials, particularly congresspeople, accountable for the deals that they cut with the president? Do they let them vote with the president on some things, give him a pass on others? Or like the Tea Party, do they go out and recruit primary challenges for these people?
Well, it's going to be very, very interesting because this is an energized, intelligent, engaged, and committed. We saw that all over the country.
And are you staying? How will you stay engaged?
Well, it's interesting. I was asked to come and lead the march.
Yes.
I was not asked to give advice and counsel. I would hope that those doors would be open, not necessarily to me, but to other people to be engaged in the strategy moving forward. But I gave President Obama some advice in early January 2008. He said, well, what advice do you have to give me? I said, my advice is don't listen to any of the old people because none of us can figure out. None of us can figure out how you got this far.
That was the best part about following this march on Facebook, because I would go to the march's Facebook page and I would be so excited because I didn't know any of those people. And I thought, thank goodness, there's another generation coming along
over. I am terribly sorry that we waited till so late in the show, but I really wanted to have an opportunity to talk about what you did on Saturday. Look, we are completely out of time for today's show. Shirley Franklin, thank you so much. Chip Lake, Beth Shapiro, Jim Galloway, thank you for a really good discussion this afternoon. We're back on Wednesday. We're going to talk about the Affordable Care Act. I don't know about you, but it's way more complicated than I can quite understand a lot of what they're talking about. And so on Wednesday, among other people, we're going to have Andy Miller of Georgia Health News come in here, because I don't think anybody knows more about healthcare than Andy does. And I'm determined to ask him questions that will help me understand what's going on. And I hope it will help you as well. That's Wednesday at 2. And then, of course, we're back Friday at 3 o'clock when Jim Galloway rejoins me. We'll probably have some legislative business to talk about by then, and certainly more in terms of the Trump presidency first week. My thanks today to our senior producer, Jenny Ament, our producer, Lisa Clark, our engineer, Tyler Morris, who's running the board. And we welcome today our new intern, Megan Moore from the University of Georgia. We're thrilled to have you on board, Megan. Megan tweeted the whole inaugural speech on Friday and did a phenomenal job. So she's already proving her value, and we're so glad she's be here. Remember, if you cannot hear us when we're on the radio, you can download our podcast on iTunes, and you can listen to the show if you go to Political Insider on the website and hear it there. I'm Bill Nigut. We'll see you again on Wednesday.